So the theme of Mark so far, and really the theme of Mark broadly, has been, you know, the authority of Christ. If you remember from the very first lesson, a lot of times in historic Christian art, you'll see Mark represented as the lion gospel. So you have the lion, the eagle, the man, and the ox. And I like to remember that because it does signify how these gospel accounts, they have these different flavors, these different distinctions that they bring about in the narrative of who Christ is. And we're picking up right there again today in chapter 8, where we see that Mark's account, we see Jesus as the lion. And it is this total king, authority. So we have studied Mark up to this point where when Jesus walks onto the scene and say that people are bringing him a deaf man or a lame man or a blind man, or there's a storm raging on a boat and all of it, everything seems chaotic, what can Jesus do with just a word? It's just, there's no question. It's who is this guy? And as he is arriving on the scene, you get a lot of this Old Testament literature that describes the coming Messiah, like they would describe sometimes the pageants of these great kings. You know, every hill would be brought low and every valley would be raised up. And that is, a king just makes a straight march. He's not going to wind around obstacles in his path. He's making a straight line, and whatever's in front of him can just get out of the way. And actually, they tried to do this for kings in this pageantry to show the people their how wonderful they are. But Jesus is the one who can do that with complete authority. So if sin is standing in the way, he can remove sins. It not just physical boundaries, but like we said, blindness, lameness. And he is not only setting himself as authoritative over the physical world, storms and the like, and healings, but he's setting himself up as authoritative over whom? Religious leaders, political leaders. He is identifying himself as Messiah. That's the problem, though. The other side of Mark's coin that we have seen so many repeated times is that nobody gets it. It's just, this is a message that's hard to understand. And so we're getting into this thing that's called the messianic secret. You see it a lot in Mark, where it even seems that obviously the people don't really know what to do with Jesus. What do we call him? Is he a prophet? Who is this guy? The religious leaders definitely don't know what to do with him. Is he some sort of insurgent? Is he on our side? Is he for us? Is he against us? Who is this guy? And the disciples really don't know how to classify him either. And of course, you have Jesus himself, who's often telling people, hey, don't, you know, he tells the demons. They say, we know who you are. He says, don't tell anybody. And there's a reason for that. We're sort of building up to how Jesus is identifying himself. He's making himself known. But those are the two major questions that are sort of raised, the ideas that are raised in the book of Mark. You have this great and complete authority of Christ, but then you have this question mark on his identity. And who is he? And that is precisely where we pick up in chapter 8. And if you think about it this way, if you've ever read like a play with multiple acts, as we get through chapter 8, it's sort of the ending of Act 1. So if Act 1 is those two things, Jesus really raising all the right questions on who he is, Act 2 is him answering that question definitively how he wants to answer it. Okay. So as we end Act 1, all the right questions have been raised. We're kind of at this climax moment. And as we move forward into Act 2, we see that Jesus, as he heads to the cross, answers the question of who he is definitively. So let's pick up here in verse 14 through 21. If I could have a reader, do you mind if I just ask? Renee, thank you. 14 through 21, the leaven of the Pharisees.
Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, "Watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" They said to him, 12. And the seven of the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, seven. And he said to them, do you not yet understand?
Okay, thank you very much. It's a lot of questions. And that's exactly, that's a good point. Jesus is really raising a lot of questions. And what are those sort of duh moments in this text? How many times has Jesus produced bread out of thin air for these guys? Do you remember? At least twice, like in just ridiculous amounts. So not just like a little thing. They are continuing to follow him and watch him. And here he is, and they're on this third sea journey. So at least the third sea journey that we get to see. The first sea journey, there's this amazing storm, and they're, of course, panicked and freaking out. And what does Jesus do? He wakes up. He said, we thought you were on our side. We thought you were for us. And he calms the storm. There's that authority. But what's the testing point? What's he testing? Their faith, what they're able to see of him. What are you supposed to take away from someone who can just, with a word, quiet the sea? What's the lesson you're supposed to learn? Okay, who is this guy? You know, that even the wind and the waves obey him. That's the question that comes out of their mouth. Who is that? That's right. Who is that? This sort of meta thing. That's what the text is having us see. They're figuring out this identity. It's the first sea journey. The second sea journey, they are on the boat alone, and they're out at night, and they're nervous, and they see Jesus walking on water. Right? And the second time, what are they supposed to see? Jesus, as he's walking on the water, and he calls Peter to come out and step in the water with him. And what are they supposed to see? There's this God, obviously, who has complete, again, authority over the elements. But it said that he was going to pass by them. And that's sort of a reference back to Exodus, where God passed by Moses, right, and revealed himself to the people. The point of the example from Mark was that he's displaying that he's one with the Father. But here we have this third sea journey, this third sea insight. And they've seen Jesus sprawling out on the fields and feeding the 5,000 and the 4,000. They've seen all this leftovers come back to them in these different amounts. The 12 baskets full of leftovers was kind of symbolic for the disciples, that there was enough for them and all their ministry. The 7 baskets full was kind of symbolic of this number of completion, this perfect. God can feed the whole world. It was in a Gentile context that Jesus has enough supply for everyone. And here they are on this third sea journey. And their bellies get a little hungry, and they look around and go, we've only got one loaf of bread. Shoot. Dang. Like, foiled again. Like, how are we going to get out of this pickle? And what was the leaven? So we get this mention right here, right when they start to say they're hungry. Jesus says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod. What do we think that leaven was? What's the influence of those guys?
And laws.
What's that?
The laws, at least for the Pharisees.
There's these laws, but when they saw Jesus, what was their response? Yeah, didn't like him.
Take their power away.
Didn't trust him. And precisely on this point of what we have seen in the past, and I know we're pulling now from months ago with Mark, but what we've seen in the past is they were able to see with their eyes Jesus do miracles. The Pharisees saw it and they hated it. Herod saw it as well. Herod even testified. We get a testimony. They say, who do you think Jesus is? And he says, I don't know. Maybe this is John the Baptist raised from the dead. Clearly there's something here, but I don't even know how to process this thing that I see, but I'm not going to believe it. Okay, I'm not going to lean into it. And here we have the belly aching disciples going, oh man, I'm not sure where our next meal is going to come from. Like, we are in a tight spot. And he says, beware of the leaven of these guys. They saw me, but they didn't believe me. How many times are you going to see me and not believe me? How many times, now this is the third time, we're going to get into a boat and you're going to be panicked again? Did you not see me? That's where you start to get those repeated questions at the end of the narrative. Jesus is saying, like, did you not see the 5,000 fed? The baskets come back. Did you not see the 4,000 fed and the baskets come back? Look, this is a deeply, like, humbling passage, because the short version of this is that our sight, which is so much of what the book of Mark is about, seeing Jesus, even the disciples who get to travel around and live with him, they see it, and then the next hurdle, it's as if it's a brand new challenge. Like, okay, like, clearly God can't do anything about this one, though. Like, you know, this time we've only got one loaf of bread. Last time we had five. You know, like, does that ever experience that you have where you're like, yeah, God has clearly demonstrated that he can tackle this problem in my life. In fact, he has answered this prayer multiple times. But this next week, it's going to happen again, and I'm going to go, shoot, it's like it's brand new. Like, do you have any stories about that? Or any? I see a lot of nodding heads. Anything y'all want to share? That seems to be the... That's okay. That was a no. That's all right.
I can share.
Like, I've been a fool. Here, listen to this.
I'll share one.
Yeah.
I think I'm getting better now, but especially when, like, Luke was born, I had a ton of anxiety over him getting sick, like even just a cold. And he has obviously been fine for 5 years, and he didn't die from a cold. But it seems like even through having grace, anytime someone got sick, I just, like, couldn't handle that anxiety, even though, like, God had shown me I'm not in control of my children's health, and he has protected them. And so I feel like that's an example of, even though he'd taken care of stuff, I would just decide, well, this time's different, and yeah, he may not do it this time, kind of thing.
I'm so glad you shared that, because that's exactly the kind of thing that I think where the rubber meets the road we deal with. And you're like, yeah, you got me through this, but whatever thing in our mind, you're like, but the circumstances are different for this next one. And you can't, like, you're not able to do it. And I'm coming to you, like, in this panic that, like, don't you understand? And I don't want to be too soft here. Like, oh, isn't that, like, kind of cute of the disciples? No, it's not. It's not cute at all. Like, Jesus is saying, do you not remember? He's rebuking them. Beware of the leaven of these other guys. They saw me repeatedly, and that was their response. They didn't trust me. And so you know, when you get into the boat as a disciple, what he's expecting to see is, oh, out of bread again. This is gonna be fun. See how this shakes out. Like, see what he's gonna do this time. Looks sick again, you know. Or that's a hard thing to say, but we do believe that he's working all things for our good. We do believe in his sovereignty. We do see that he is capable to bring us and our circumstances. He's able to make good on them. But I think we bring to the table, oh, you're going to drop the ball this time. Like, you can't do this. And that's the leaven of the Pharisee. And that's the thing that condemned them to hell, is that they're looking at him and they reject him. Like, I see you, but I don't trust you. And he says that's the kind of thing that even a disciple has to learn over time. That's the influence. The leaven is, we can talk about that part, but the leaven's the influence. It's the part of the thing that gets in the dough that if you let rumble underneath the surface, it grows. And you've talked about kind of fear in this. That would be one that I would put in my category too. It's like, I let that fear grow in me, and it starts to change my decisions. I try to manipulate and control. I try to find bread elsewhere. I'm going to, like, okay, you're here. I've only got one loaf of bread. We got to land this ship. I got to get to the market. I got to get some stuff for myself. You start making rash decisions instead of what they were supposed to do. It was repeated intentionally. Like, I'm bringing you back to the same place because you have to learn this lesson again. That's a humbling thought. Like, things in our life where God's saying, like, I'm going to bring you right back here again. try again. Like, better luck this time. I'm going to go Pam first. I got you, John.
I think it's oftentimes with me, not that I don't think he's capable. I know he's capable. I've seen it over and over again. It's that he will choose not to this time, right? His will be done. And I think that's what I get caught up on a lot of times, is that fear that, well, he doesn't have to do it. You know what I mean?
That's a good point. You mean, so he might answer in a way that,
right,
you know, hey, it's not the one you were looking for.
Right.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I think you're still battling that dynamic of, I don't believe that you are present here. I don't believe that you see me. I don't believe that you have my best interest. And only if I see this very specific thing will I be validated that you are working. Yeah, yeah.
This is what I want, right?
Yep. And that was kind of what the Pharisees were doing. You have to validate yourself to me in this very specific way, or else we have nothing to do with you. And that's part of the messianic secret that we're kind of getting to, is that he's revealing himself in his own way.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a way that the disciples don't understand, they don't like, and that the Pharisees don't like either. So that's kind of exactly where he's going, saying, I get the right of self-disclosure. Pay attention, because what will happen is you will start to do exactly that. You're only validated if you fit this mold that I have for you of how you're going to answer this question. You know, I'm fine with you being a miracle worker, but you got to do it exactly in my timing and the way that I want, and then I'll give you my trust. And that's why the tests can continue to get repeated. John?
Jesus describing unbelief as leaven implies that it's contagious, essentially, that it spreads. You know, if you have to be aware of it, then that's what I'm thinking of. It implies that you can catch it from someone else.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, does that plays out in my life, in my experience? That's one of the things that you see in that's a good point for like the halls of. Hey, we're going to get Sunday lunch, and how are you doing? You know, it's good to catch up with you. How are things going? And you start to get into like, well, let me just tell you about how things are going awful in my life. You know, if you're that kind of thing where it's, you sort of snowball into doubt, and you snowball into all the things that are wrong, and you snowball into like, well, we've only got this one loaf of bread, and you wouldn't believe it. We were out in the ship. Having someone in that moment, like a brother in Christ who steps in with, let's call it empathy, like, oh, let's just sit there in this grief and let's wallow, right? That is the kind of thing that spreads. You know, your lives get nervous, and there is a million spiders to look out for in the world. You know, you're kind of constantly seeing things in that way, but I think the reverse is, leaven's obviously used in both ways in Scripture, you know, the influence on a good front. So faith and how they were actually being, these are the guys that wrote the epistles in the New Testament. So these are the guys that are calling us to faith later on. These are the ones that are stirring us up to love and good works. They're being the leaven in the opposite direction. So you're right. And isn't that the truth? Like one person in a crowd, one person in a group of conversations, one person at the family dinner table who actually steps up and is like, no, we should repent of that and trust the Lord. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. You know, what was I thinking? It's easy to get kind of caught up. And I'd imagine on the boat, you know, there one guy's like, hey, there's one loaf here. And everyone starts to panic. We will see later on that takes Peter's confession, sort of a turning point. And the disciples start to rally a little bit more to who Christ is. So I think you're right, John. Any thoughts there before we move on? So they were overly concerned with what they saw as insufficient resources. They were anxious over earthly things. And here's a thought about the disciples. Why are they continually allowed to progress with Christ? They're not just rejected. They're not like the Pharisees. The difference here is not that they refused to see. It's just that they couldn't see very clearly. So that's an important point. It's not that they refused to see. It's that they couldn't see clearly. And that dullness needs the grace and the tenderness of the Lord. So who does that sound like? Us. You know, hopefully our position as Christians is not that we refuse to see God's goodness. It's the truth sometimes is that we are dull to see it and we have to be continually moved to see it more. That's a great difference. If you remember, one of the key parables of Mark was the parable of the sower. And it was, you know, what kind of soil are you? Well, the thing that continued to encourage the disciples was anyone who's not turning away but says, Lord, I see, but I don't see clearly. I believe, but I help my unbelief. It was the disciples who, after that parable, who came after Jesus, who didn't walk away, who he said, now you can come and follow me. They came and knocked on his door and said, you got to tell us more. That is encouraging to me as a lifelong disciple. Like, I don't see clearly, but it's not a refusal to see. And as long as we're continuing to tap on that door and say, like, teach me more, help me see, that is in the position that we're supposed to be in. We can acknowledge that. We can embrace that. That's a humbling thing, but that's okay. So that if they succumb to the unbelieving leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod, however, they will never see. And if they continue to follow along the way, Jesus will multiply the meager resources of their understanding. So that's sort of the point of that. So think of things, how things panned out as they go forward. So think about where they are now in the gospel. Think about when they go forward. Think of Peter's denial, right? Of them not being able to quite see yet. They see a little bit, but they can't quite see. Think of Peter, how he goes to deny Jesus. The men leave Jesus at the cross. He's getting nailed up. And it says, in Mark's account, it says all the men leave, but only the women stay. Even the women who see Jesus in his resurrection, it says that they run out to tell the disciples. But in Mark's account, it says that they stop. And they decide not to tell anybody for fear of the religious leaders. Think about how they're processing seeing who Christ is. None of them have just like dropped the coin where they're just like scorched earth. Like, he's God, no fear of man. Like, everyone has this little hang up as they're learning to see more about God. It's changing their behavior over time. But then go a little bit beyond that. Like, those are also the people who became martyrs eventually one day. They saw more and more until they got to that point. So their major failure was not their blindness, but their failure to recognize their blind, like their limited sight, their limited blindness. So let's look at the next parable. It sort of shines light on this. Verses 22 through 26, Jesus heals a blind man at Bethsaida. Matthew Ingram, do you mind reading that? Thank you.
And they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought to him a blind man and begged him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, do you see anything? And he looked up and said, I see people, but they look like trees walking. Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, do not even enter the village.
Thank you very much. So in the Markan context, we've already mentioned this, but Jesus has total authority. So what's the deal here? It's a bit shocking when it seems like his attempt to heal someone didn't work. So this is the point in the movie where the superhero powers begin to wane and he has to believe in himself and, you know, do something. And then he can do it again. That's not what's happening here at all. This miracle is a parable. So exactly what we have just been talking about, this like inability to see. What Jesus is doing physically, he's showing the disciples. Obviously, this man is, we see that this man is pulled aside to do this miracle, but we also know that this disciples are privy to this miracle. They wrote it down for us. They saw what happened. And what is that parable? Let's kind of walk through it. So Jesus goes to heal this man. He says, can you see? And it's, sort of. Like, I see, but it's blurry. I kind of think these are people, they might be trees. I can't make out the distinction along the edges. And it's not that, okay, well, try again, you know, apply a little bit more, you know, pressure this time, whatever. As some people say, you know, the spit in the mud is sort of like recreation, you know, sort of working with clay again, you know, wiping that symbolically on his eyes. But I think the chief point to take away here is that's what's playing out with the disciples. They can see, and they have this limited version of sight, and they've seen Jesus do these miracles, and they've seen all these things. We're about to get even more clarity in just a second. Jesus starts to ask them outright, like, who do you say that I am? Like, who am I? And they can basically see, like, the fuzzy edges. Like, I kind of think I see who you are, but I don't know that I can fully make it out. And then it's the second application of grace, which I would say, you know, on the meta level, Act 1 of Mark's gospel is exactly everyone seeing fuzzy. Act 1 of this book so far is everyone getting a little bit of a picture of Jesus for them to step back and go like, okay, yeah, okay, I think I really know who you are. And then Act 2 is him coming in with the salve and going, you had no idea. Like, you had all these expectations, but you had no idea. And what we're going to get to and that no idea is mainly that suffering servant. So here is authority, authority, authority. And everyone's like, okay, great, power. He can do miracles, wrangle the sea, wrangle the oceans. You know, what can he wrangle for me in my life? You know, my political enemies, he's going to take power from me, maybe from the Pharisees' perspective. But they can't see clearly. But the second application of grace, that salve to the eyes, is what Jesus is going to do. Now, we also have another clause here in sort of the ending of this little healing miracle, which is that Jesus tells the man, hey, don't, when you go back into the village, don't tell anybody what happened. And again, this is kind of feeding into this same theme. Now, do we think that these men who brought this man to be healed, all of a sudden he goes off with Jesus and he comes back and he's healed? Like, what are they going to think? They're going to put two and two together. But some commenters think that Jesus saying, like, hey, don't say anything, just kind of gives Jesus and the disciples an opportunity to leave. Okay, so it's sort of just buying them time, because at this point, so if you were to like map out what Jesus is doing geographically, now he's making a beeline to Jerusalem. So he's going to the cross. Okay, that's what's happening. So he's spread out. He's all over the place doing all these miracles. The Jews and the Gentiles, everyone's gotten a really good, he went to his hometown, we remember that. Everyone's gotten a good opportunity to see his miracles. Everyone's kind of seen the fuzzy tree. But now he's making a beeline to Jerusalem. And what's in Jerusalem? It's the cross. Like, I'm going to show you what the Messiah is really about. Okay, he's the suffering servant. You're repeatedly going to get this clause, the phrase in Mark, the Son of Man. This is from Daniel. So this is what the Messiah, the deliverer, is truly like. Okay, you can make up your mind about him, but what he's truly going to be is he's going to be pinned up on a cross, shedding his blood for you. He's the high priest from Hebrews. And that's what he's coming to do. So let's look at the last section of chapter 8, verses 27 through 38. Peter's confession. So that's a longer section, 27 through 38. Leah, would you mind reading?
Sure. Through 38.
Yeah, 27 through 38.
And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan. For you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels.
Thank you very much. A fascinating section of Scripture coming off of all of this context of can we see rightly? So let's kind of walk through it together, and then we'll see how Jesus applies sort of that salve and helps us to truly see. We'll listen to his words exactly. So Jesus went with the disciples through Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked disciples. Now he begins to ask, okay, all right, guys, pop quiz. Who do you say that I am? So all this has been sort of leading up exactly to this. Here's your moment, guys. What's their answer? How do they respond? Verse 28.
They say what other people say.
Yeah, so they kind of say what other people. That's right. They're like, not really sure. Some people say you're a prophet. Some kind of say you're a teacher. We're sort of working it out. You know, gonna let Jay speak up because I don't want to say anything. Like you imagine the disciples are a little sheepish, but they're proving Jesus' point that he just made with the parable. Right? Everyone's got this kind of fuzzy, undistinct picture of who I am. That's the consensus right now. Everyone's kind of looking like, I think these are people. They might be trees. Not really sure what this is. Might be a prophet. Might be a teacher. John the Baptist raised from the dead. Like, who knows? Kind of crazy, crazy answers. And then you have Peter. So we have a major turning point in the narrative. But it's an instructive one. Peter gets it right, kind of. You know, so Peter steps up and he says, Jesus says, okay, well, who do you say that I am? You've answered for other people. He says, you're the Christ. You're the Christ. But he doesn't know what that answer means. That's been such a point of this messianic secret, of sort of Jesus kind of keeping it close. Have you ever read the Gospels and kind of thought that was weird? Somebody ever, like, on your own read, why doesn't he just tell them? You know, like, why don't you just tell them who you are? They would have to believe you. Well, clearly not. So verse 30, he says he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. Jesus is going to sort of reserve this right of self-disclosure. And there's not so much of a question mark of what is happening in the Gospel of Mark. Most people believe there is this messianic secret. A lot of people are speculating as to why. But what it seems is that they would have totally leveraged that information in a way that was just inconsistent with what Christ was there to do. So imagine the Pharisees, and Jesus is there kind of walking around just saying that he's the Christ. Right? There's this, I don't know, potentially instantly being seized upon as a disruptor, sort of a political activist. So that's kind of what he's there to do. Or you have him, you know, openly telling everyone that he's the Messiah and there's social revolt. Or openly telling everyone that that he's the Messiah and the disciples, you know, kind of want to gain following with him, not because they're going to, you know, hey, we get to take up our cross and follow him and die, but because he's going, you know, we take up the crown, we can follow him and rule. You know, so there's all these ideas that you can begin to gain from that, and he keeps it sort of close to the vest because when it really comes out who he's there and what he's there to do, they might not have wanted it so much anymore. Right? Because what is he there to do? He began to teach them, this is verse 31, he began to teach them that the Son of Man, so this is this phrase kind of from Daniel, this Messiah, he must suffer many things. He must be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. He was rejected outright for who he was. He was rejected for what they saw of him, not what he claimed to be. They rejected him for his miracles. They rejected him for his words and his presence, his understanding of the law as he articulated it to them. And after 3 days, he would rise again. And he said these things plainly. And that's an interesting thing. So it's like, in that messianic secret idea, here it is, and the gospel account just says, and Jesus just kind of told him outright, like, this is what I am. This is who I am. I am the Messiah, yes, I am the Christ, but I am the suffering servant. I'm coming to die. So what does Peter do immediately? Yeah.
Who he thinks as Christ, but
I don't know. I don't know that he sees it yet because I mean, Jesus, I mean, he's like, look, you're on the side of Satan here. So Jesus is telling them, hey, this is, you know, I'm going to put the salve on your eyes. This is the clear picture. You ready for it? Boom. I'm coming to die. That's who I am. And Peter just takes him, he's like, come over here. Yeah, I know like 3 seconds ago, I had no clue who you were, but let me tell you exactly who you are right now. And you're not that guy. All right, you're not going to the cross. You're not dying. That's not what the Messiah is supposed to do. That's not what the Son of Man is supposed to do. I know. You do your miracle thing. I'll do your PR, right? And he says, get behind me, Satan. So why did he say, get behind me, Satan? What do we know? Do we remember, rather, Jesus run in with Satan in the Gospel of Mark? Remember what kind of, what? Why is Peter in line with Satan here? Yep, you can circumvent this whole dying thing. You don't have to do that. You know, just follow me. So he's almost verbatim. He's like he's in that line with Satan. You want to say something else?
Do you think he was calling him Satan, associated with the serpent, or do you think he's calling him like opposer? You're in my way. You know, you are in the way of the right path. Get out of my way. Or is he really making a connection with him and the Satan?
I think he's making an actual connection. You know, because we get that explicitly in the account of Mark, where Jesus goes to the wilderness and he gets that exact thing from Satan. And you're right, it is an echo from the beginning. It's the temptation of the first Adam. It's where the second Adam succeeded. And you remember that? That was such a fun, at least for me, that was such a fun, like here you have in the garden, you had all this abundance and you had like one no. And then Jesus, you had this wilderness where you have, he's hungry. He has nothing. So Adam had everything. He had one no, and he failed. Jesus has nothing. And he's like, here, take this. And he says, no, he succeeds. I mean, he's better in every way. Such a remarkable thing. But I think in telling Peter, get behind me, Satan, he's again just reiterating that point of you don't see, you don't get it. This is the point. Okay, and so we kind of end this call and in this class. He called the crowd his disciples. And he said, if anyone would come after me. So now he's turning it. He's saying, well, this is true of me. But now he's giving clarity of all those who would follow me. This is going to be true of you as well. So if you thought following me meant, you know, riding my coattails to political earthly victory, Let me disabuse you of that. But if you think you follow me into everlasting life, then let me also remind you that the way to it is through the grave. But take heart, I've overcome the world. I will come through that. He says, if anyone come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake in the Gospels and the good news will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in glory of his Father and with the holy angels. One day Jesus really will be clearly seen by everybody. Y'all know that? We hear a lot of that in scriptures. Jesus, rider on the white horse, faithful and true. King of kings, Lord of lords. One day everyone will see exactly who it is. But at that moment, it'll be too late. And it's those who reject this picture, who reject the Lamb, those who reject the Son never get the Father. Okay, so that's who we're dealing with. It's the clear picture of the Son. And he's warning disciples, you've got to be comfortable with that. And it's not just this sort of sentimental, like, I think for us, it lands a little sentimental. Like, if you're going to follow me, you might not be liked. You follow me, you might not have every job opportunity. You know, you might not be able to run for office. We kind of think about it in those terms. Those are very, very true. But Jesus' words are not merely that. They are, and they will be to many of these men. Hey, if you follow me, it is all the way, even unto death. It's that sort of cutting off level of speech that's a real challenge to their sight. And I would say that's why I think it challenges our sight heavily as well. We don't often have to give up much to follow Christ. And so I think the stakes are a little low for us when we begin to meditate upon it and think about it. But the call here is that it's a total call. Whoever would lose their life for my sake and the gospel's. And so why I highlighted that is that that's what our inheritance is. We are stewards of the gospel. We're ministers of reconciliation. There should be this very active sense that Covenant of Grace and the members of it are in league with this Son of Man who's going into the world to declare who he is. He's the suffering servant. And we should expect to be the fools of the world. Sort of embrace that. And sometimes people will put a test on it and say, like, if you're not being persecuted, maybe you're not being faithful. That's possibly true, and maybe not. But I would wonder if there's a little bit of pressure for that in my own life. Like, I get Sunday to Sunday, it's easy to come. All y'all expect me to talk about Jesus. But not everyone loves it when I talk about Jesus on a Tuesday dinner. You know, and it's so I don't, because it's easy. And Jesus says, look, be ashamed of me, even to the point of death. That this is the call. You follow me all the way. There's this push that we would hold on in this ministry of proclaiming the gospel. I'm going to read you a good quote by R.T. France. We'll take a few questions. He says, what Jesus calls for here is a radical abandonment of one's own identity and one's self-determination. It's a call to join in the march of the place of execution. And it follows appropriately from this. Such self-denial is on a different level altogether from giving up just chocolates for Lent. It's not the denial of something to the self, but is a complete denial of the self itself. The self itself. So not just, you know, we don't just, I'll follow you, Christ, I'll give up lots of things. That's, I'll follow you, Christ, I'll give up me. I'll follow you, Christ, I'll give up me. And until we see that, that's where we shift from the blurry tree vision to, okay, I can see you now. The gospel has a lot of stakes. I got to give up everything. And I have to let go of everything. Not just some different behaviors and habits, although that's part of it. But it's the complete denial of the self that he calls for. So we'll park it there and pick up in chapter 9. Any thoughts as we close? Any thoughts on this? Matt?
Yeah, I was just thinking a lot about something we've talked about in the past, like, 14 years.
Casually.
Like, our marriage, I mean, regardless of, like, even patterns where I see, like, moments of needing to learn the same thing, right, like what we were talking about earlier, like, there's this general sense of that other shoe coming to drop, right? As if God is this chaotic, fickle person that's just kind of haphazardly reacting to my chaos, my choices. And it's almost the same thing here. Like Peter wants to say, well, don't do it the wrong way. You have to do it the right way, right? Like, what if you break it? What is God going to do then? How do we turn that around? And there is no other shoe, though, right? Like, I have to say this all the time. Like, there's nothing that I could do if I make this choice or that choice that's going to shatter the future of our family or where I end up, right? Or even, like, we can look at the world and say, like, the same thing. It's too far gone. It can't be fixed.
Yeah.
Right? God's better off to just bring another flood. Just do it, you know? Like, get it over with, and we'll go on wherever he has planned. As opposed to, like, no, he is fully sovereign. He's Lord of all of these situations, and it's not just simply that he has the power to bring his will to bear in response to terrible things or this broken situation, but also that he knew how it was going to go. He knows this path. He knows all contingencies. He knows where we're going. Our like, it's that moment of faith, not just simply like some ethereal, like, I believe it and I hope that it, like, I have this great hope. But it's like, right now, I know he knows where we're going.
Yep.
That's what I'm grabbing onto.
that's where I rest, right? And the beauty of the cross then becomes not just all of this cascading terribleness that leads to the death of the Son of God, but a purposeful mission to show there is no circumstance, there is no thing that can divert God's will. Even the worst thing that we can witness is the most glorious thing that we'll sing up for eternity.
Yeah, that's yeah, and well put. And have you all read maybe Kevin DeYoung's "Just Do Something"? Like so much of that, have y'all not read? Well, that's such a wonderful part of you mentioned the application of sort of being frozen in, you know, waiting for the next shoe to drop. But if we do believe, like, He is sovereign, He knows all contingencies, then maybe the argument of that book is, seek first the kingdom. All these things will be added to you. Like, just go. So we freeze up of, what decision am I going to make? If I don't do the right one, He's going to be thrown off, and He can't work in that situation, and I will have messed up, and that's the road that, shoot, He's not there in that road. I'm over there, and He can't do anything about it, and it's just not true. So He saw that Judas was going to be the disciple that He was going to be. He saw that Peter was going to be the denying disciple that He was going to be, and chose them both. That's a great way to phrase it. That we just, you know, if, as long as it's not sin, make the decision, hold the faith, and move on, and watch him work. You know, marry the girl, take the job, you know, pack the truck and move. And but God will be there. I'm sort of kidding, sort of not. But, that's right. You can't find yourself in a situation where you messed it up. He can't. He, you know, He's not there because you took a wrong turn. That's right. Any other thoughts? Everyone see clearly? Think you see clearly?